Ra raised her gaze. It isn't your fault, do you hear me? Not you. It's those savages, those Wahshis, who are to blame. They bring shame on me as a Pashtun. They've disgraced the name of my people, and you're not alone, Hamshira. We get mothers like you all the time, mothers who come here who can't feed their children because the Taliban won't let them go out and make a living. So you don't blame yourself. No one here blames you. I understand. He leaned forward. Hamshira, I understand. Laila wiped her eyes with a cloth of her burqa. As for this place, Zaman sighed, motioning with his hand. You can see that it's in dire state. We're always underfunded, always scrambling, improvising. We get little or no support from the Taliban, but we manage. Like you, we do what we have to do. Allah is good and kind, and Allah provides. And as long as He provides, I will see to it that Aziza is fed and clothed. That I promise you. Laila nodded. All right? He was smiling companionably. But don't cry, Hamshira. Don't let her see you cry. Laila wiped her eyes again. God bless you, she said thickly. God bless you, brother. But when the time for goodbyes came, the scene erupted precisely as Laila had dreaded. Aziza panicked. All the way home, leaning on Mariam, Laila heard Aziza's shrill cries. In her head, she saw Zaman's thick, calloused hands close around Aziza's arms. She saw them pull, gently at first, then harder, then with force, to pry Aziza loose from her. She saw Aziza kicking in Zaman's arms as he hurriedly turned the corner. Heard Aziza screaming as though she were about to vanish from the face of the earth. And Laila saw herself running down the hallway, head down, a howl rising up her throat. I smell her, she told Mariam at home. Her eyes swam unseeingly past Mariam's shoulder, past the yard, the walls, to the mountains, brown as smoker's spit. I smell her sleep smell. Do you? Do you smell it? Oh, Laila Jo, said Mariam. Don't. What good is this? What good? At first, Rashid humored Laila and accompanied them, her, Mariam, and Zalmai, to the orphanage, though he made sure, as they walked, that she had an eyeful of his grievous looks, an earful of his rants, over what a hardship she was putting him through. How badly his legs and back and feet ached walking to and from the orphanage. He made sure she knew how awfully put out he was. I'm not a young man anymore, he said. Not that you care. You'd run me to the ground if you had your way, but you don't, Laila. You don't have your way. They parted ways 2 blocks from the orphanage, and he never spared them more than 15 minutes. A minute late, he said, and I start walking. I mean it. Laila had to pester him, plead with him, in order to spin out the allotted minutes with Aziza a bit longer. For herself and for Mariam, who was disconsolate over Aziza's absence. Though, as always, Mariam chose to cradle her own suffering privately and quietly. And for Zalmai, too, who asked for a sister every day and through tantrums that sometimes dissolved into inconsolable fits of crying. Sometimes on the way to the orphanage, Rashid stopped and complained that his leg was sore. Then he turned around and started walking home in long, steady strides, without so much as a limp. Or he clucked his tongue and said, It's my lungs, Laila. I'm short of breath. Maybe tomorrow I'll feel better, or the day after, we'll see. He never bothered to feign a single raspy breath. Often, as he turned back and marched home, he lit a cigarette. Laila would have to tail him home, helpless, trembling with resentment and impotent rage. Then one day he told Laila he wouldn't take her anymore. I'm too tired from walking the streets all day, he said, looking for work. Then I'll go by myself, Laila said. You can't stop me, Rashid. Do you hear me? You can hit me all you want, but I'll keep going there. Do as you wish. But you won't get past the Taliban. Don't say I didn't warn you. I'm coming with you, Mariam said. Layla wouldn't allow it. You have to stay home with Salmai. If we get stopped, I don't want him to see. And so Layla's life suddenly revolved around finding ways to see Aziza. Half the time, she never made it to the orphanage. Crossing the street, she was spotted by the Taliban and riddled with questions. What's your name? Where are you going? Why are you alone? Where is your mahram? Before she was sent home. If she was lucky, she was given a tongue-lashing or a single kick to the rear, a shove in the back. Other times, she met with assortments of wooden clubs, fresh tree branches, short whips, slaps, often fists. One day, a young talib beat Layla with a radio antenna. When he was done, he gave a final whack to the back of her neck and said, I see you again. I'll beat you until your mother's milk leaks out of your bones. That time, Layla went home. She lay on her stomach, feeling like a stupid, pitiable animal, and hissed as Mariam arranged damp cloths across her bloodied back and thighs. But usually, Layla refused to cave in. She made as if she were going home, then took a different route down side streets. Sometimes she was caught, questioned, scolded, 2, 3, even 4 times in a single day. Then the whips came down and the antenna sliced through the air, and she trudged home, bloodied, without so much as a glimpse of Aziza. Soon, Layla took to wearing extra layers, even in the heat, 2, 3 sweaters beneath the burqa, for padding against the beatings. But for Layla, the reward, if she made it past the Taliban, was worth it. She could spend as much time as she liked then, hours, even, with Aziza. They sat in the courtyard, near the swing set, among other children and visiting mothers, and talked about what Aziza had learned that week. Aziza, said Kaka Zaman, made it a point to teach them something every day, reading and writing most days, sometimes geography, a bit of history or science, something about plants, animals. But we have to pull the curtains, Aziza said, so the Taliban don't see us. Kaka Zaman had knitting needles and balls of yarn ready, she said, in case of a Taliban inspection. We put the books away and pretend to knit. One day, during a visit with Aziza, Layla saw a middle-aged woman, her burqa pushed back, visiting with 3 boys and a girl. Layla recognized the sharp face, the heavy eyebrows, if not the sunken mouth, and gray hair. She remembered the shawls, the black skirts, the curt voice, how she used to wear her jet-black hair tied in a bun so that you could see the dark bristles on the back of her neck. Layla remembered this woman once forbidding the female students from covering, saying women and men were equal, that there was no reason women should cover if men didn't. At one point, Khola Rangmal looked up and caught her gaze, but Layla saw no lingering, no light of recognition in her old teacher's eyes. They're fractures along the earth's crust, said Aziza. They're called faults. It was a warm afternoon, a Friday, in June of 2001. They were sitting in the orphanage's back lot, the 4 of them, Layla, Zalmai, Mariam, and Aziza. Rashid had relented this time, as he infrequently did, and accompanied the 4 of them. He was waiting down the street by the bus stop. Barefoot kids scampered about around them. A flat soccer ball was kicked around, chased after listlessly. And on either side of the faults, there are these sheets of rock that make up the earth's crust, Aziza was saying. Someone had pulled the hair back from Aziza's face, braided it, and pinned it neatly on top of her head. Layla begrudged whoever had gotten to sit behind her daughter to flip sections of her hair one over the other had asked her to sit still. Aziza was demonstrating by opening her hands, palms up, and rubbing them against each other. Zalmai watched this with intense interest. Tectonic plates, they're called? Tectonic, Layla said. It hurt to talk. Her jaw was still sore, her back and neck ached. Her lip was swollen, and her tongue kept poking the empty pocket of the lower incisor Rashid had knocked loose 2 days before. Before Mami and Bobby had died and her life turned upside down, Laila would have never believed that a human body could withstand this much beating, this viciously, this regularly, and keep functioning. Right. And when they slide past each other, they catch and slip. See, Mami? And it releases energy, which travels to the earth's surface and makes it shake. You're getting so smart, Mariam said. So much smarter than your dumb khala. Aziza's face glowed, broadened. You're not dumb khala, Mariam. And Coco Samon said that, sometimes, the shifting of rocks is deep, deep below, and it's powerful and scary down there. But all we feel on the surface is a slight tremor. Only a slight tremor. The visit before this one, it was oxygen atoms in the atmosphere, scattering the blue light from the sun. If the Earth had no atmosphere, Aziza had said a little breathlessly, the sky wouldn't be blue at all, but a pitch-black sea, and the sun a big bright star in the dark. Is Aziza coming home with us this time? Zalmai said. Soon, my love, Laila said. Soon. Laila watched him wander away, walking like his father, stooping forward, toes turned in. He walked to the swing set, pushed an empty seat, ended up sitting on the concrete, ripping weeds from a crack. Water evaporates from the leaves, Mami. Did you know? The way it does from laundry, hanging from a line. And that drives the flow of water up the tree, from the ground and through the roots, then all the way up the tree trunk, through the branches and into the leaves. It's called transpiration. More than once, Laila had wondered what the Taliban would do about Kaka Zaman's clandestine lessons if they found out. During visits, Aziza didn't allow for much silence. She filled all the spaces with effusive speech, delivered in a high, ringing voice. She was tangential with her topics, and her hands gesticulated wildly, flying up with a nervousness that wasn't like her at all. She had a new laugh, Aziza did. Not so much a laugh, really, as nervous punctuation, meant, Laila suspected, to reassure. And there were other changes. Laila would notice the dirt under Aziza's fingernails, and Aziza would notice her noticing and bury her hands under her thighs. Whenever a kid cried in their vicinity, snot oozing from his nose, or if a kid walked by bare-assed, hair clumped with dirt, Aziza's eyelids fluttered and she was quick to explain it away. She was like a hostess embarrassed in front of her guests by the squalor of her home, the untidiness of her children. Questions of how she was coping were met with vague but cheerful replies. Doing fine, Khala. I'm fine. Do kids pick on you? They don't, Mami. Everyone's nice. Are you eating, sleeping all right? Eating, sleeping too, yes. We had lamb last night. Maybe it was last week. When Aziza spoke like this, Laila saw more than a little of Mariam in her. Aziza stammered now. Mariam noticed it first. It was subtle but perceptible, and more pronounced with words that began with T. Laila asked Zaman about it. He frowned and said, I thought she'd always done that. They left the orphanage with Aziza that Friday afternoon for a short outing and met Rashid, who was waiting for them by the bus stop. When Zalmai spotted his father, he uttered an excited squeak and impatiently wriggled from Laila's arms. Aziza's greeting to Rashid was rigid, but not hostile. Rashid said they should hurry. He only had 2 hours before he had to report back to work. This was his first week as a doorman for the Intercontinental. From noon to 8, 6 days a week, Rashid opened car doors, carried luggage, mopped up the occasional spill. Sometimes, at day's end, the cook at the buffet-style restaurant let Rashid bring home a few leftovers, as long as he was discreet about it. Cold meatballs, sloshing in oil, fried chicken wings, the crust gone hard and dry, stuffed pasta shells turned chewy, stiff, gravelly rice. Rashid had promised Laila that once he had some money saved up, Aziza could move back home. Rashid was wearing his uniform, a burgundy-red polyester suit, white shirt, clip-on tie, visor cap pressing down on his white hair. In this uniform, Rashid was transformed. He looked vulnerable, pitiably bewildered, almost harmless. Like someone who had accepted without a sigh of protest the indignities life had doled out to him. Someone both pathetic and admirable in his docility. They rode the bus to Titanic City. They walked into the riverbed, flanked on either side by the makeshift stalls clinging to the dry banks. Near the bridge, as they were descending the steps, a barefoot man dangled dead from a crane, his ears cut off, his neck bent at the end of a rope. In the river, they melted into the horde of shoppers milling about. The money changers and bored-looking NGO workers, the cigarette vendors, the covered women who thrust fake antibiotic prescriptions at people and begged for money to fill them. Whip-toting, naswar-chewing talibs patrolled Titanic City on the lookout for the indiscreet laugh, the unveiled face. From a toy kiosk, between a pustine coat vendor and a fake flower stand, Zalmay picked out a rubber basketball with yellow and blue swirls. "Pick something," Rashid said to Aziza. Aziza hedged, stiffened with embarrassment. "Hurry, I have to be at work in an hour." Aziza chose a gumball machine. The same coin could be inserted to get candy, then retrieved from the flap door, coin returned below. Rashid's eyebrows shot up when the seller quoted him the price. A round of haggling ensued, at the end of which Rashid said to Aziza contentiously, as if it were she who'd haggled him, "Give it back, I can't afford both." On the way back, Aziza's high-spirited facade waned the closer they got to the orphanage. The hand stopped flying up, her face turned heavy. It happened every time. It was Laila's turn now, with Mariam pitching in, to take up the chattering, to laugh nervously, to fill the melancholy quiet with breathless, aimless banter. Later, after Rashid had dropped them off and taken a bus to work, Laila watched Aziza wave goodbye and scuff along the wall in the orphanage backlot. She thought of Aziza's stutter, and of what Aziza had said earlier about fractures and powerful collisions deep down, and how sometimes all we see on the surface is a slight tremor. "Get away, you!" Zalmay cried. "Hush," Mariam said. "Who are you yelling at?" He pointed. "There! That man!" Laila followed his finger. There was a man at the front door of the house, leaning against it. His head turned when he saw them approaching. He uncrossed his arms, limped a few steps toward them. Laila stopped. A choking noise came up her throat. Her knees weakened. Laila suddenly wanted, needed, to grope for Mariam's arm, her shoulder, her wrist, something, anything to lean on. But she didn't. She didn't dare. She didn't dare move a muscle. She didn't dare breathe or blink even, for fear that he was nothing but a mirage shimmering in the distance, a brittle illusion that would vanish at the slightest provocation. Laila stood perfectly still and looked at Tariq until her chest screamed for air and her eyes burned to blink. And somehow, miraculously, after she took a breath, closed and opened her eyes, he was still standing there. Tariq was still standing there. Laila allowed herself to take a step toward him, then another, and another, and then she was running. Mariam. Upstairs in Mariam's room, Zalmay was wound up. He bounced his new rubber basketball around for a while, on the floor, against the walls. Mariam asked him not to, but he knew that she had no authority to exert over him, and so he went on bouncing his ball, his eyes holding hers defiantly. For a while they pushed his toy car, an ambulance with bold red lettering on the sides, sending it back and forth between them across the room. Earlier, when they had met Tariq at the door, Zalmay had clutched the basketball close to his chest and stuck a thumb in his mouth, something he didn't do anymore except when he was apprehensive. He had eyed Tariq with suspicion. "Who is that man?" he said now. "I don't like him." Mariam was going to explain, say something about him and Laila growing up together, but Zalmay cut her off and set to turn the ambulance around so the front grill faced him, and, when she did, he said he wanted his basketball again. "Where is it?" he said. "Where's the ball Baba John got me? Where is it? I want it! I want it!" His voice rising and becoming more shrill with each word. "It was just here," Mariam said, and he cried. "No, it's lost. I know it. I just know it's lost. Where is it? Where is it?" "Here," she said, fetching the ball from the closet where it had rolled to. But Zalmay was bawling now and pounding his fists, crying that it wasn't the same ball. It couldn't be, because his ball was lost. And this was a fake one. Where had his real ball gone? Where? 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 He screamed until Layla had to come upstairs to hold him, to rock him and run her fingers through his tight, dark curls, to dry his moist cheeks and cluck her tongue in his ear. Mariam waited outside the room. From atop the staircase, all she could see of Tariq were his long legs, the real one and the artificial one, in khaki pants, stretched out on the uncarpeted living room floor. It was then that she realized why the doorman at the Continental had looked familiar the day she and Rashid had gone there to place the call to Jalil. He'd been wearing a cap and sunglasses. That was why it hadn't come to her earlier. But Mariam remembered now, from 9 years before, remembered him sitting downstairs, patting his brow with a handkerchief, and asking for water. Now all manners of questions raced through her mind. Had the sulfa pills, too, been part of the ruse? Which one of them had plotted the lie, provided the convincing details? And how much had Rashid paid Abdul Sharif, if that was even his name, to come and crush Layla with the story of Tariq's death? Layla. Tariq said that one of the men who shared his cell had a cousin who'd been publicly flogged once for painting flamingos. He, the cousin, had a seemingly incurable thing for them. "Entire sketchbooks," Tariq said. "Dozens of oil paintings of them, wading in lagoons, sunbathing in marshlands, flying into sunsets too, I'm afraid." "Flamingos," Layla said. She looked at him sitting against the wall, his good leg bent at the knee. She had an urge to touch him again, as she had earlier by the front gate when she'd run to him. It embarrassed her now to think of how she'd thrown her arms around his neck and wept into his chest, how she'd said his name over and over in a slurring, thick voice. Had she acted too eagerly, she wondered, too desperately? Maybe so. But she hadn't been able to help it, and now she longed to touch him again, to prove to herself again that he was really here, that he was not a dream, an apparition. "Indeed," he said, "flamingos." When the Taliban had found the paintings, Tariq said, they'd taken offense at the bird's long, bare legs. After they tied the cousin's feet and flogged his soles bloody, they had presented him with a choice: either destroy the paintings or make the flamingos decent. So the cousin had picked up his brush and painted trousers on every last bird. "And there you have it, Islamic flamingos," Tariq said. Laughter came up, but Layla pushed it back down. She was ashamed of her yellowing teeth, the missing incisor, ashamed of her withered looks and swollen lip. She wished she'd had the chance to wash her face, at least comb her hair. "But he'll have the last laugh, the cousin," Tariq said. "He painted those trousers with watercolor. When the Taliban are gone, he'll just wash them off." He smiled. Layla noticed that he had a missing tooth of his own and looked down at his hands. "Indeed." He was wearing a pakol on his head, hiking boots, and a black wool sweater tucked into the waist of gray khaki pants. He was half smiling, nodding slowly. Layla didn't remember him saying this before, this word "indeed," and this pensive gesture, the fingers making a tent in his lap, the nodding, it was new too. Such an adult word, such an adult gesture, and why should it be so startling? He was an adult now, Tariq, a 25-year-old man with slow movements and a tiredness to his smile. Tall, bearded, slimmer than in her dreams of him, but with strong-looking hands, workman's hands, with tortuous, full veins. His face was still lean and handsome, but not fair-skinned any longer. His brow had a weathered look to it, sunburned, like his neck, the brow of a traveler at the end of a long and wearying journey. His pakol was pushed back on his head, and she could see that he'd started to lose his hair. The hazel of his eyes was duller than she remembered, paler, or perhaps it was merely the light in the room. Laila thought of Tariq's mother, her unhurried manners, the clever smiles, the dull purple wig, and his father, with his squinty gaze, his wry humor. Earlier at the door, with a voice full of tears, tripping over her own words, she told Tariq what she thought had happened to him and his parents, and he had shaken his head. So now she asked him how they were doing, his parents. But she regretted the question when Tariq looked down and said, a bit distractedly, "Passed on." "I'm so sorry." "Well, yes, me too. Here." He fished a small paper bag from his pocket and passed it to her. "Compliments of Aliona." Inside was a block of cheese in plastic wrap. "Aliona, it's a pretty name." Laila tried to say this next without wavering. "Your wife?"
"My goat."
He was smiling at her expectantly, as though waiting for her to retrieve a memory. Then Laila remembered. The Soviet film. Aliona had been the captain's daughter, the girl in love with the first mate. That was the day that she, Tariq, and Hasina had watched Soviet tanks and jeeps leave Kabul. The day Tariq had worn that ridiculous Russian fur hat. "I had to tie her to a stake in the ground," Tariq was saying, "and build a fence, because of the wolves. In the foothills where I live, there's a wooded area nearby, maybe a quarter mile away, pine trees mostly, some fir, deodars. They mostly stick to the woods, the wolves do, but a bleeding goat, one that likes to go wandering, that can draw them out. So the fence, the stake." Laila asked him which foothills. "Pir Panjal, Pakistan," he said. "Where I live is called Muri. It's a summer retreat, an hour from Islamabad. It's hilly and green, lots of trees, high above sea level. So it's cool in the summer, perfect for tourists." The British had built it as a hill station near their military headquarters in Rawalpindi, he said, for the Victorians to escape the heat. "You could still spot a few relics of the colonial times," Tariq said. "The occasional tea room, tin-roofed bungalows, called cottages, that sort of thing." The town itself was small and pleasant. The main street was called the Mall, where there was a post office, a bazaar, a few restaurants, shops that overcharged tourists for painted glass and hand-knotted carpets. Curiously, the mall's one-way traffic flowed in one direction one week, the opposite direction the next week. "The locals say that Ireland's traffic is like that too in places," Tariq said. "I wouldn't know. Anyway, it's nice. It's a plain life, but I like it. I like living there." "With your goat, with Aliona." Laila meant this less as a joke than as a surreptitious entry into another line of talk, such as who else was there with him, worrying about wolves eating goats. But Tariq only went on nodding. "I'm sorry about your parents too," he said.
"You heard?"
"I spoke to some neighbors earlier," he said. A pause, during which Laila wondered what else the neighbors had told him. "I don't recognize anybody, from the old days, I mean.
They're all gone. There's no one left you'd know."
"I don't recognize Kabul."
"Neither do I," Laila said, "and I never left."
"Mami has a new friend," Zalmai said after dinner later that same night, after Tariq had left. "A man." Rashid looked up.
"Does she now?"
Tariq asked if he could smoke. They had stayed a while at the Nazir Bagh refugee camp near Peshawar, Tariq said, tapping ash into a saucer. There were 60,000 Afghans living there already when he and his parents arrived.
It wasn't as bad as some of the other cams, like God forbid Jalozai, he said. I guess at one point, it was even some kind of model camp, back during the Cold War, a place the West could point to and prove to the world they weren't just funneling arms into Afghanistan. But that had been during the Soviet War, Tariq said, the days of jihad and worldwide interest and generous funding and visits for Margaret Thatcher. You know the rest, Laila. After the war, the Soviets fell apart and the West moved on. There was nothing at stake for them in Afghanistan anymore, and the money dried up. Now Nazarbagh is tents, dust, and open sewers. When we got there, they handed us a stick and a sheet of canvas and told us to build ourselves a tent. Tariq said what he remembered most about Nazarbagh, where they had stayed for a year, was the color brown. Brown tents, brown people, brown dogs, brown porridge. There was a leafless tree he climbed every day, where he straddled a branch and watched the refugees lying about in the sun, their sores and stumps in plain view. He watched little emaciated boys carrying water in their jerry cans, gathering dog droppings to make fire, carving toy AK-47s out of wood with dull knives, lugging the sacks of wheat flour from which no one could make bread that held together. All around the refugee town, the wind made the tents flap. It hurled stubbles of wheat everywhere, lifted kites flown from the roofs of mud hovels. A lot of kids died. Dysentery, TB, hunger, you name it. Mostly that damn dysentery. God, Laila, I saw so many kids buried. There's nothing worse a person can see. He crossed his legs. It grew quiet again between them for a while. My father didn't survive that first winter, he said. He died in his sleep. I don't think there was any pain. That same winter, he said, his mother caught pneumonia and almost died, would have died, if not for a camp doctor who worked out of a station wagon made into a mobile clinic. She would wake up all night long, feverish, coughing out thick, rust-colored phlegm. The queues were long to see the doctor, Tariq said. Everyone was shivering in line, moaning, coughing, some with shit running down their legs, others too tired or hungry or sick to make words. But he was a decent man, the doctor. He treated my mother, gave her some pills, saved her life that winter. That same winter, Tariq had cornered a kid. 12, maybe 13 years old, he said evenly. I held a shard of glass to his throat and took his blanket from him. I gave it to my mother. He made a vow to himself, Tariq said, after his mother's illness, that they would not spend another winter in camp. He'd work, save, move them to an apartment in Peshawar with heating and clean water. When spring came, he looked for work. From time to time, a truck came to camp early in the morning and rounded up a couple of dozen boys, took them to a field to move stones, or an orchard to pick apples in exchange for little money, sometimes a blanket, a pair of shoes. But they never wanted him, Tariq said. One look at my leg and it was over. There were other jobs. Ditches to dig, hovels to build, water to carry, feces to shovel from outhouses. But young men fought over these jobs, and Tariq never stood a chance. Then he met a shopkeeper one day, that fall of 1993. He offered me money to take a leather coat to Lahore. Not a lot, but enough. Enough for one or maybe 2 months' apartment rent. The shopkeeper gave him a bus ticket, Tariq said, and the address of a street corner near the Lahore rail station, where he was to deliver the coat to a friend of the shopkeeper's. I knew already, of course I knew, Tariq said. He said that if I got caught, I was on my own, that I should remember that he knew where my mother lived. But the money was too good to pass up. And winter was coming again. How far did you get? Laila asked. Not far, he said and laughed, sounding apologetic, ashamed. Never even got on the bus. But I thought I was immune, you know, safe. As though there was some accountant up there, somewhere, a guy with a pencil tucked behind his ear, who kept track of these things, who tallied things up, and he'd look down and say, Yes, yes, he can have this. We'll let it go. He's paid some dudes already, this one. It was in the seams, the hashish, and it spilled all over the street when the police took a knife to the coat. Tariq laughed again when he said this, a climbing, shaky kind of laugh, and Laila remembered how he used to laugh like this when they were little, to cloak embarrassment, to make light of things he'd done that were foolhardy or scandalous. He has a limp, Zalmay said.
Is this who I think it is?
He was only visiting, Mariam said.
Shut up, you, Rashid snapped, raising a finger.
He turned back to Laila.
Well, what do you know? Laili and Majnoon reunited, just like old times.
His face turned stony.
So you let him in, here, in my house. You let him in. He was in here with my son.
You duped me. You lied to me, Laila said, gritting her teeth. You had that man sit across from me and... You knew I would leave if I thought he was alive.
And you didn't lie to me? Rashid roared. You think I didn't figure it out? About your hat on me? You take me for a fool, you whore?
The more Tariq talked, the more Laila dreaded the moment when he would stop. The silence that would follow. The signal that it was her turn to give account, to provide the why and how and when, to make official what he surely already knew. She felt a faint nausea whenever he paused. She avoided his eyes. She looked down at his hands, at the coarse, dark hairs that had sprouted on the back of them in the intervening years. Tariq wouldn't say much about his years in prison, save that he'd learned to speak Urdu there. When Laila asked, he gave an impatient shake of his head. In this gesture, Laila saw rusty bars and unwashed bodies, violent men and crowded halls, and ceilings rotting with moldy deposits. She read in his face that it had been a place of abasement, of degradation and despair. Tariq said his mother tried to visit him after his arrest. 3 times she came, but I never got to see her, he said. He wrote her a letter and a few more after that, even though he doubted that she would receive them.
And I wrote you.
You did?
Oh, volumes, he said. Your friend Rumi would have envied my production.
Then he laughed again, uproariously this time, as though he was both startled at his own boldness and embarrassed by what he had let on. Zalmay began bawling upstairs.
Just like old times, then, Rashid said. The two of you. I suppose you let him see your face.
She did, said Zalmay. Then to Laila, you did, mummy. I saw you.
Your son doesn't care for me much, Tariq said when Laila returned downstairs.
I'm sorry, she said. It's not that. He just... Don't mind him. Then quickly she changed the subject, because it made her feel perverse and guilty to feel that about Zalmay, who was a child, a little boy who loved his father, whose instinctive aversion to the stranger was understandable and legitimate.
And I wrote you, volumes, volumes.
How long have you been in Marie?
Less than a year, Tariq said.
He befriended an older man in prison, he said, a fellow named Salim, a Pakistani, a former field hockey player who had been in and out of prison for years and who was serving 10 years for stabbing an undercover policeman. Every prison has a man like Salim, Tariq said. There was always someone who was cunning and connected, who worked the system and found you things. Someone around whom the air buzzed with both opportunity and danger. It was Salim who had sent out Tariq's queries about his mother. Salim, who had sat him down and told him in a soft, fatherly voice that she had died of exposure. Tariq spent 7 years in the Pakistani prison.
I got off easy, he said. I was lucky. The judge sitting on my case, it turned out, had a brother who'd married an Afghan woman. Maybe he showed mercy. I don't know.
When Tariq's sentence was up, early in the winter of 2000, Salim gave him his brother's address and phone number.
The brother's name was Said. He said Said owned a small hotel in Marie, Tariq said. 20 rooms and a lounge, a little place to cater to tourists. He said, tell him I sent you. Tariq had liked Marie as soon as he'd stepped off the bus. The snow-laden pines, the cold, crisp air, the shuttered wooden cottages, smoke curling up from chimneys. Here was a place, Tariq had thought knocking on Said's door, a place not only worlds removed from the wretchedness he'd known, but one that made even the notion of hardship and sorrow somehow obscene, unimaginable. I said to myself, here's a place where a man can get on. Tariq was hired as a janitor and handyman. He did well, he said, during the one-month trial period at half pay that Said granted him. As Tariq spoke, Laila saw Said, whom she imagined narrow-eyed and ruddy-faced, standing at the reception office window, watching Tariq chop wood and shovel snow off the driveway. She saw him stooping over Tariq's legs, observing as Tariq lay beneath the sink fixing a leaky pipe. She pictured him checking the register for missing cash. Tariq's shack was beside the cook's little bungalow, he said. The cook was a matronly, old widow named Adiba. Both shacks were detached from the hotel itself, separated from the main building by a scattering of almond trees, a park bench, and a pyramid-shaped stone fountain that, in the summer, gurgled water all day. Laila pictured Tariq in his shack, sitting up in bed, watching the leafy world outside his window. At the end of the grace period, Said raised Tariq's pay to full, told him his lunches were free, gave him a wool coat, and fitted him for a new leg. Tariq said he'd wept at the man's kindness. With his first month's full salary in his pocket, Tariq had gone to town and bought Aliona. Her fur is perfectly white, Tariq said, smiling. Some mornings when it snowed all night, you look out the window and all you see of her is two eyes and a muzzle. Laila nodded. Another silence ensued. Upstairs, Zalmay had begun bouncing his ball again against the wall. I thought you were dead, Laila said. I know, you told me. Laila's voice broke. She had to clear her throat, collect herself. The man who came to give the news, he was so earnest. I believed him, Tariq. I wish I hadn't, but I did. And then I felt so alone and scared. Otherwise, I wouldn't have agreed to marry Rashid. I wouldn't have. You don't have to do this, he said softly, avoiding her eyes. There was no hidden reproach, no recrimination in the way he had said this, no suggestion of blame. But I do, because there was a bigger reason why I married him. There's something you don't know, Tariq. Someone. I have to tell you. Did you sit and talk with him too? Rashid asked Zalmay. Zalmay said nothing. Laila saw hesitation and uncertainty in his eyes now, as if he had just realized that what he disclosed had turned out to be far bigger than he'd thought. I asked you a question, boy. Zalmay swallowed. His gaze kept shifting. I was upstairs, playing with Mariam. And your mother? Zalmay looked at Laila apologetically, on the verge of tears. It's all right, Zalmay, Laila said. Tell the truth. She was downstairs, talking to that man, he said in a thin voice, hardly louder than a whisper. I see, said Rashid. Teamwork. As he was leaving, Tariq said, I want to meet her. I want to see her. I'll arrange it, Laila said. Aziza. Aziza. He smiled, tasting the word. Whenever Rashid uttered her daughter's name, it came out sounding unwholesome to Laila, almost vulgar. Aziza. It's lovely. So is she. You'll see. I'll count the minutes. Almost 10 years had passed since they'd last seen each other. Laila's mind flashed to all the times they'd met in the alley, kissing in secret. She wondered how she must seem to him now. Did he still find her pretty? Or did she seem withered to him, reduced, pitiable, like a fearful, shuffling old woman? Almost 10 years, but for a moment standing there with Tariq in the sunlight, it was as though those years had never happened. Her parents' deaths, her marriage to Rashid, the killings, the rockets, the Taliban, the beatings, the hunger, even her children, all of it seemed like a dream, a bizarre detour, a mere interlude between that last afternoon together and this moment. Then Tariq's face changed, turned grave. She knew this expression. It was the same look he'd had on his face that day, all those years ago, when they'd both been children, when he'd unstrapped his leg and gone after Khadim. He reached with one hand now and touched the corner of her lower lip. "He did this to you," he said coldly. At his touch, Layla remembered the frenzy of that afternoon again, when they'd conceived Aziza. His breath on her neck, the muscles of his hips flexing, his chest pressing against her breasts, their hands interlocked. "I wish I'd taken you with me," Tariq nearly whispered. Layla had to lower her gaze, try not to cry. "I know you're a married woman and a mother now. And here I am, after all these years, after all that's happened, showing up at your doorstep. Probably it isn't proper or fair, but I've come such a long way to see you and, oh, Layla, I wish I'd never left you." "Don't," she croaked. "I should have tried harder. I should have married you when I had the chance. Everything would have been different then. Don't talk this way, please. It hurts." He nodded, started to take a step toward her, then stopped himself. "I don't want to assume anything. And I don't mean to turn your life upside down, appearing like this out of nowhere. If you want me to leave, if you want me to go back to Pakistan, say the word, Layla. I mean it. Say it and I'll go. I'll never trouble you again. I'll..." "No," Layla said more sharply than she'd intended to. She saw that she'd reached for his arm, that she was clutching it. She dropped her hand. "No, don't leave, Tariq. No, please stay." Tariq nodded. "He works from noon to 8. Come back tomorrow afternoon. I'll take you to Aziza." "I'm not afraid of him, you know." "I know. Come back tomorrow afternoon." "And then?" "And then? I don't know. I have to think. This is..." "I know it is," he said. "I understand. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for a lot of things." "Don't be. You promised you'd come back, and you did." His eyes watered. "It's good to see you, Layla." She watched him walk away, shivering where she stood. She thought, volumes, and another shudder passed through her, a current of something sad and forlorn, but also something eager and recklessly hopeful. Mariam. "I was upstairs playing with Mariam," Zalmay said.
"And your mother?"
She was downstairs, talking to that man."
"I see," said Rashid. "Teamwork."
Mariam watched his face relax, loosen. She watched the folds clear from his brow. Suspicion and misgiving winked out of his eyes. He sat up straight, and for a few brief moments, he appeared merely thoughtful, like a ship captain informed of imminent mutiny, taking his time to ponder his next move. He looked up. Mariam began to say something, but he raised a hand and, without looking at her, said,
"It's too late, Mariam."
To Zalmay, he said coldly,
"You're going upstairs, boy."
On Zalmay's face, Mariam saw alarm. Nervously, he looked around at the three of them. He sensed now that his tattletale game had let something serious, adult serious, into the room. He cast a despondent, contrite glance toward Mariam, then his mother. In a challenging voice, Rashid said,
"Now!"
He took Zalmay by the elbow. Zalmay meekly let himself be led upstairs. They stood frozen, Mariam and Layla, eyes to the ground, as though looking at each other would give credence to the way Rashid saw things, that while he was opening doors and lugging baggage for people who wouldn't spare him a glance, a lewd conspiracy was shaping behind his back, in his home, in his beloved son's presence. Neither one of them said a word. They listened to the footsteps in the hallway above, one heavy and foreboding, the other the pattering of a skittish little animal. They listened to muted words passed, a squeaky plea, a curt retort, a door shut, the rattle of a key as it turned. Then one set of footsteps returning, more impatiently now. Mariam saw his feet pounding the steps as he came down. She saw him pocketing the key, saw his belt, the perforated end wrapped tightly around his knuckles. The fake brass buckle dragged behind him, bouncing on the steps. She went to stop him, but he shoved her back and blew by her. Without saying a word, he swung the belt at Layla. He did it with such speed that she had no time to retreat or duck or even raise a protective arm. Layla touched her fingers to her temples, looked at the blood, looked at Rashid with astonishment. It lasted only a moment or two, this look of disbelief, before it was replaced by something hateful. Rashid swung the belt again. This time, Layla shielded herself with a forearm and made a grab at the belt. She missed, and Rashid brought the belt down again. Layla caught it briefly before Rashid yanked it free and lashed at her again. Then, Layla was dashing around the room, and Mariam was screaming words that ran together and imploring Rashid, as he chased Layla as he blocked her way and cracked his belt at her. At one point, Layla ducked and managed to land a punch across his ear, which made him spit a curse and pursue her even more relentlessly. He caught her, threw her up against the wall, and struck her with the belt again and again, the buckle slamming against her chest, her shoulder, her raised arms, her fingers, drawing blood wherever it struck. Mariam lost count of how many times the belt cracked, how many pleading words she cried out to Rashid, how many times she circled around the incoherent tangle of teeth and fists and belt, before she saw fingers clawing at Rashid's face, chipped nails digging into his jowls and pulling at his hair and scratching his forehead. How long before she realized, with both shock and relish, that the fingers were hers? He let go of Layla and turned on her. At first, he looked at her without seeing her, then his eyes narrowed, appraised Mariam with interest. The look in them shifted from puzzlement to shock, then disapproval, disappointment even, lingering there a moment. Mariam remembered the first time she'd seen his eyes, under the wedding veil, in the mirror with Jalil looking on, how their gazes had slid across the glass and met, his indifferent, hers docile, conceding, almost apologetic. Apologetic. Mariam saw now in those same eyes what a fool she had been. Had she been a deceitful wife? She asked herself. A complacent wife? A dishonorable woman? Discreditable? Vulgar? What harmful thing had she willfully done to this man to warrant his malice, his continual assaults, the relish with which he tormented her? Had she not looked after him when he was ill, fed him and his friends, cleaned up after him dutifully? Had she not given this man her youth? Had she ever justly deserved his meanness? The belt made a thump when Rashid dropped it to the ground and came for her. Some jobs, that thump said, were meant to be done with bare hands. But just as he was bearing down on her, Mariam saw Layla, behind him, pick up something from the ground. She watched Layla's hand rise overhead, hold, then come swooping down against the side of his face. Glass shattered. The jagged remains of the drinking glass rained down to the ground. There was blood on Layla's hands, blood flowing from the open gash on Rashid's cheek, blood down his neck, on his shirt. He turned around, all snarling teeth and blazing eyes. They crashed to the ground, Rashid and Layla thrashing about. He ended up on top, his hands already wrapped around Layla's neck. Mariam clawed at him. She beat at his chest. She hurled herself against him. She struggled to uncurl his fingers from Layla's neck. She bit them. But they remained tightly clamped around Layla's windpipe,
and Mariam saw that he meant to carry this through.
Mariam backed away and left the room. She was aware of a thumping sound from upstairs, aware that tiny palms were slapping against the locked door. She ran down the hallway. She burst through the front door, crossed the yard. In the tool shed, Mariam grabbed the shovel. Rashid didn't notice her coming back into the room. He was still on top of Layla, his eyes wide and crazy, his hands wrapped around her neck. Layla's face was turning blue now, and her eyes had rolled back. Mariam saw that she was no longer struggling.
He's going to kill her, she thought. He really means to.
And Mariam could not, would not allow that to happen. He'd taken so much from her in 27 years of marriage. She would not watch him take Layla too. Mariam steadied her feet and tightened her grip around the shovel's handle. She raised it. She said his name. She wanted him to see.
Rashid!
He looked up. Mariam swung. She hit him across the temple. The blow knocked him off Layla. Rashid touched his head with the palm of his hand. He looked at the blood on his fingertips. Then at Mariam. She thought she saw his face soften. She imagined that something had passed between them, that maybe she had quite literally knocked some understanding into his head. Maybe he saw something in her face too, Mariam thought, something that made him hedge. Maybe he saw some trace of all the self-denial, all the sacrifice, all the sheer exertion it had taken her to live with him for all these years, live with his continual condescension and violence, his fault-finding and meanness. Was that respect she saw in his eyes? Regret? But then his upper lip curled back into a spiteful sneer, and Mariam knew then the futility, maybe even the irresponsibility, of not finishing this. If she let him walk now, how long before he fetched the key from his pocket and went for that gun of his upstairs in the room where he'd locked Zalmay? Had Mariam been certain that he would be satisfied with shooting only her, that there was a chance he would spare Layla, she might have dropped the shovel. But in Rashid's eyes, she saw murder for them both. And so Mariam raised the shovel high, raised it as high as she could, arching it so it touched the small of her back. She turned it so the sharp edge was vertical, and as she did, it occurred to her that this was the first time that she was deciding the course of her own life. And with that, Mariam brought down the shovel. This time, she gave it everything she had. Layla. Layla was aware of the face over her, all teeth and tobacco and foreboding eyes. She was dimly aware, too, of Mariam, a presence beyond the face, of her fists raining down. Above them was the ceiling, and it was the ceiling Layla was drawn to, the dark markings of mold spreading across it like ink on a dress. The crack in the plaster that was a stolid smile or a frown, depending on which end of the room you looked at it from. Layla thought of all the times she had tied a rag around the end of a broom and cleaned cobwebs from the ceiling. The three times she and Mariam had put coats of white paint on it. The crack wasn't a smile any longer now, but a mocking leer. And it was receding. The ceiling was shrinking, lifting, rising away from her and towards some hazy dimness beyond. It rose until it shrank to the size of a postage stamp, white and bright, everything around it blotted out by the shuttered darkness. In the dark, Rashid's face was like a sunspot. Brief little bursts of blinding light before her eyes now, like silver stars exploding. Bizarre geometric forms in the light, worms, egg-shaped things, moving up and down, sideways, melting into each other, breaking apart, morphing into something else, then fading, giving way to blackness. Voices muffled and distant. Behind the lids of her eyes, her children's faces flared and fizzled. Aziza, alert and burdened, knowing, secretive. Zalmay looking up at his father with quivering eagerness. It would end like this then, Layla thought. What a pitiable end. But then the darkness began to lift. She had a sensation of rising up, of being hoisted up. The ceiling slowly came back, expanded, and now Layla could make out the crack again,
and it was the same old dull smile. She was being shaken. "Are you all right? Answer me.